Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. Now, I'm very excited about the guest we have on the show today and the discussion we're going to have about crypto money. Fazar Masani is blockchain lead at RMB and chairman of the South African Financial Blockchain Consortium. Fazam is one of the leading experts on blockchain and cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, not just in South Africa, but worldwide. So I'm thrilled to have him on the show today. Thank you for making the time, Fazam.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks, Duncan.
Now, we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion today, everything from the nature of money to the geopolitical and social implications of crypto money. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to learn a bit more about you personally, Fazam, because I know there's a really interesting backstory that you have to share. You were born in the U.S., but you're an Iranian national. Is that right?
Actually, so it's a little complicated. So my parents are from Iran originally.
Okay.
They were both born there, grew up there. I was actually born in Los Angeles, but then grew up in Kenya, studied in California at Berkeley, studied also in Paris, worked in San Francisco as a consultant at Deloitte for about a year. Then came to Africa and came back to Africa and worked at McKinsey for about 5 years. And then I've been at RMB for about 5.5 years now.
Okay. So what did you study?
Economics.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Economics.
And so you went to school in Kenya?
So I grew up my entire life, my formative years until I was 18 years old in Kenya. I actually, after that, spent 1 year at the Baha'i World Center as a gardener. I was planting and weeding for about a year before I actually went to university.
Okay. So why South Africa? Why did you come down here?
So really the only reason I first came was that I wanted to work at McKinsey in consulting and in Africa. And at the time, Johannesburg was the only office that McKinsey had that serviced the whole of sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay.
So I came here just for work, actually. Fell in love with this beautiful country and then decided to stay.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned a gardener, you said,
yes.
The Baha'i World Center?
The Baha'i World Center.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you actually proudly proclaim on your Twitter account and elsewhere that you are a member of the Baha'i faith.
Correct.
In fact, you say that your faith has fundamentally shaped who you are today and your outlook on the world, including on the world you're now focusing on, cryptocurrencies and blockchain.
Correct.
Why is that, and what do adherents to the Baha'i faith believe?
Sure. So first of all, I think it's important to say, like, I think there's a lovely resonance that gets created when all different aspects of your life kind of come together in cohesion. The Baha'i faith is a world religion. It's about 170 years old, so not very, very old at all. The most recent world religion. And the author of the Baha'i revelation, called Baha'u'llah, which means the glory of God, basically talked about that now is the time for the human race to be united. And he said, if you look at history, we've had lots of divisions, and even our social structures have been becoming more and more global, from families to tribes to city-states, nation-states. And he actually says, and the Baha'i writings talk about how actually the whole idea of the nation-state, we need to transgress that. We need to move beyond that to recognize the unity of the entire human race. So he wrote over 100 volumes of books. One of the reasons that the Baha'i faith is so dear to me is that it appeals to both my mind and my heart. And I think whenever we're looking at truth and whenever you need to actually investigate anything in life, whether it's scientific or whatever it may be, truth should stack up to any test it is put to. So from my perspective, one of the central tenets of the Baha'i Faith is individual and independent investigation of truth. So there's a lot of encouragement about asking questions and trying to understand the world we're in, and not blindly following things for the sake of blindly following things. That becomes a very, very dangerous thing. So primarily, I think, to wrap that introduction off, the Baha'i Faith really, as I said, believes in the unity of the human race, believes that actually true religion is only one, that all the different religions are chapters of one revelation from some unknowable essence that we happen to call God. And that there is one kind of that unknowable essence. Just for practicality, we use the term God, but it's beyond our comprehension.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the nation states and
what's
going to happen to them. We're going to get into a big discussion about that a bit later in the show. But while you were talking about your Baha'i Faith, it made me wonder, and maybe it's probably a good idea to ask this question of anyone who's involved in this blockchain and Bitcoin space, etc. Yeah. Where do you fit on the political spectrum? Are you a libertarian? What is your view of the world?
So I actually don't like to label myself at all.
Okay.
If there's anything, I would say I'm a lover of the human race, of humanity. I think, unfortunately, by creating labels, the very label that you give yourself is immediately a cause of division with someone that doesn't label themselves as that.
Yes.
So my view is that I'm trying to do good for humanity, for my people. My people are humans all over the world. And I have lots of differing thoughts about different things. So, and I think that's one of the fallacies of our current political systems, is that it's insane to try to divide a population in all its complexity into two different camps. Different issues on each side of the spectrum, you should have different thoughts and different perspectives on. And we oftentimes push ourselves into our own labels that become self-fulfilling prophecies that don't allow us to think widely and broadly. So my view is I don't like labels very much. I'm a human, I'm a Baha'i. Those are probably the two labels that I'd like to give to myself. Both of those labels are all-encompassing.
Okay. We've seen how the U.S. has become so polarized, of course.
Correct. Correct.
Between the left and right, and people have become so intransigent in their views, so set in their ways that it's actually spilling over into violence in that country.
I mean, I just got back from the U.S. About a month ago, and people don't want to talk about politics now.
Okay.
It's become so divisive. People are very unhappy, and that's always very sad when there's that much disunity.
Mm. Right, let's get down to brass tacks now, and let's start talking about money.
Sure,
because
let's do it.
Ultimately, crypto is money. It's a form of money. But we met a couple of weeks back now, I think it was actually last week, to plan for this podcast.
Yeah.
And we decided that a great starting point would be to have a brief discussion on the history of money. What is money exactly for Zom, and what gives it its value?
Sure. So it's obviously a topic we could talk for ages on. But if we think about the role of money in history, it's really been a social tool for the interaction of humans, right? And it's always really come down to the allocation of the scarce resources that we have on this planet. People that had lots of money were entitled to use lots of resources, and those that don't aren't entitled to use many. Now, how do you actually do that, and how is that, does that come about? And so one of the things is that for anything that needs to give people rights to finite resources, that thing we call money needs to also be finite, right? Because if it's not finite and everybody can get their hands on it, then it loses its ability to allocate resources. So if we think all the way back to the agricultural revolution 12,000 years ago, we actually used cows as forms of money. And, you know, the textbook definition of money when it talks about what money does is, you know, that it's a store of value, it's a means of exchange, and it's a unit of account. And so you can imagine that a cow is not the best thing at doing those things. You know, one of the important things about money is that it's fungible, which means that one unit equals another unit. Cows are not fungible because you then ask, is it a fat cow, a skinny cow? You don't ask whether it's a fat dollar or a skinny dollar. A dollar is a dollar, so it's fungible. So from cows, we kind of started looking about and the evolution of money continued along the lines of understanding what are the characteristics and features of money and what makes good money good money. And really, Duncan, there are six things and six attributes that make good money. The first is that it must be divisible. And the reason it needs to be divisible is because it needs to be traded for the least valuable asset in our society. It needs to be durable, because if it's not durable, it can't be a store of value at all. It needs to be fungible, and we talked about fungibility just now. And the reason it needs to be fungible is it facilitates trade. If something is not fungible, then you spend more time talking about the means of your trade than the actual trade itself. Okay. Then it needs to be portable. So the more portable money is, the more trade is actually promulgated and promoted. It needs to be scarce. This is a really, really important attribute that we'll talk more about, and specifically as it relates to our current financial system and whether the money we use right now is scarce or not.
Certainly we see in places where it's not scarce because it's been printed by the government, it loses its value
absolutely.
Very rapidly.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then the last one, which is the sixth attribute, is acceptability. So even if those first five are the best form of money that we have, but yet it's not accepted, then it doesn't form very well, it doesn't function very well as money. So it's those six. Now, if we look back at history, if we go from like cows to then animal hides to shells and salt and metals, you know, and then from metals to depository receipts that actually gave someone a claim on that metal, to 1971 when President Nixon actually took us off the gold standard so that we just have paper. And I think it's important to note that it's only been 46 years since that decision took place. And so there's really nothing scarce that backs a US dollar or any fiat currency at the moment. And that will have lots of implications for the future. So money, this thing that we call money, I think really, really lies in our imagination and is based on faith. The only reason you would ever accept $100 or you would accept 100 rand in South Africa is because you believe that somebody else will accept it after you've accepted it.
And it will continue to hold its value.
It will continue to hold its value, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's really, money is more of a psychological and social concept than an economic one. So it's a very interesting thing when you actually sit back to understand and try to think about what it means. Where does it actually come from? Mm. Does it ever get destroyed? How does it get destroyed? So it's fascinating.
So the money we understand in the world today, certainly until crypto money came along, was the concept of a fiat currency. This is a currency that's backed by a national government. Yeah. And it's almost come to define our societies, right? It's arguably, correct me if I'm wrong here, arguably the thing that almost defines what a nation state is its currency in many ways.
In many ways, you're right. Mm. So let's talk a little about that, because I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about what does it mean that a nation state is backing a currency. Generally, nation states have central banks. Sometimes a region has a central bank, like the European Central Bank. That's a region, not just a country. Even those countries have their own central banks. Now, a central bank is meant to be an independent institution. And when we say that it is backed by a government, remember, a $100 note is a liability of a central bank. The 100 rand note over here is a liability of the central bank in South Africa, the South African Reserve Bank. Now, typically, when something is a liability, that means that somebody owes you something. Mm. That's all it means. That's what a liability is. So very few people have actually tried to redeem their liability, which is 100 rands. And actually, a few months ago, when I was at the South African Reserve Bank, I said, this 100 rand is a liability, is it not? And they said, yes, it is. And I said, I'd like to redeem it. And there's a little bit of confusion in the room, and then a little of nervous laughter, because probably not many people do that. And then the response that I received was that, don't worry, the RAND is, we can assure you of the full confidence of our financial system. So even with that answer right there, you can see that central banks, they rely on the confidence of people using their tokens of value, which are their currency or fiat currency. But many people think that it's backed by, you know, the resources of a country. And while that has an effect on it, absolutely, there's no direct relationship between the two. And it's very clear to see that. And the one very clear way to see that is, if you look at the central bank of the US, the Federal Reserve, over the past 10 years, that balance sheet has grown from about $1 trillion to about $4.5 trillion. Now, if you look at the compounded annual growth rate from 1 to 4.5, so 4.5 times that has gone, the compounded annual growth rate is relatively high. Mm. Now, as you know, over the past 10 years, the US has not been growing that much. So if you look at the economy, there is no way that the economy has grown 4.5 times in the past 10 years. And so there isn't a direct relationship between the resources and the economy of a country and the amount of money that it puts out into its system. Mm. And in South Africa, we know this very well because our border just north, our neighbor just north of our border, Zimbabwe, I mean, it experienced serious hyperinflation. Yet Zimbabwe has a lot of resources. You know, it just wasn't being managed very well. So one of the things that gives fiat value, fiat currency, when I say fiat currency, I'm talking about a government currency, is that governments can demand taxes to be paid in that currency. So even if you're using anything else, any other form of value, to extinguish your obligation towards a government, they can stipulate that you need to extinguish it and satisfy it in terms of the local currency. And if you need to do that, that means you need to buy some of it. Mm. And as you know, when you buy something, it provides some pricing for it. But there also comes a point where if central banks and currency and countries don't manage that money supply so well, it can become very dangerous. We can have hyperinflation, and then there is no reason to actually be paying anything within that currency.
So along comes crypto.
Yep.
What is a cryptocurrency exactly? How does it have any inherent value, and how do you correctly value it?
Great question. So let's go back to our six characteristics that we talked about money. And again, if we talk about its divisibility and its durability, cryptocurrencies perform those functions very well. In fact, before going through those factors, let's actually just try to define what a cryptocurrency is. So really, a cryptocurrency is based on a decentralized and distributed network of participants that that use a particular protocol and in which there is a token of value associated with that protocol that is limited. We could get into a lot of the nitty-gritty, but effectively there is a sphere or a discipline coming up more and more called crypto economics. And it's really trying to understand what gives all these different participants the incentives required to make a system such as Bitcoin work. When Bitcoin started, as you know, it started in 2009, it wasn't a very valuable thing because nobody knew what it was and nobody used it. And so even though it performed some of the first five functions very, very well, it was divisible, it's durable. Some could debate with you whether it's fungible or not, but technology is moving in the direction to make cryptocurrencies fungible. It's very, very portable, and it's scarce. And in fact, I would argue that it is better at all of those five attributes than any currency or any monetary token we've ever had in society. The only thing that it hasn't had up until now, or relatively recently, is this idea of being accepted. And being accepted is a cultural phenomenon. And it takes time to change culture. So as you can see, the world has been waking up to this new phenomenon, this fantastic technology. And it's not just Bitcoin. There are many other cryptocurrencies, over 1,000 other cryptocurrencies. And as society wakes up to the fact that these may form a better form of money, then they may start using it more. And it's always helpful to think about the first time pieces of paper was used as money. Remember, if there was a chap that was walking around town with gold coins, and everybody used gold coins to kind of transact with one another, and then all of a sudden somebody said, hey, I've got a new business, please give me a gold coin, I'll give you a piece of paper that gives you a claim on a gold coin. Very few people would have accepted that because that wasn't the norm. Then maybe there was a brave soul that said, okay, let me try this out. And then just imagine how much luck he had in giving somebody else a piece of paper instead of a gold coin. And then there was also another brave soul that maybe accepted the piece of paper, tested out the goldsmith to see if the goldsmith would actually redeem the gold. And ultimately, we've moved completely away from gold. And so a similar slow kind of cultural change will need to take place for this to happen. And I say slow, but I think our paces of change are increasing dramatically with the advent of the things like the internet that promote global communication.
We've seen this incredible volatility in Bitcoin, well, all the cryptocurrencies, yes, over the last 2 weeks or so.
Yeah.
And I think Jamie Dimon's remarks had an impact there, as well as the
Chinese
developments in China, yes, with the exchanges. But is there a way, you have an economics background,
yeah,
is there a way to determine what a fair value is for these cryptocurrencies?
Sure. I think it's very difficult to determine what the fair value is for anything, to be honest. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it comes down to supply and demand. Anything of value, from a gold coin to a Bitcoin to the US dollar to your home, is based on supply and demand. That's it. And it's a very simple thing, but it seems to elude some people. Now, when we talk about Bitcoins themselves, and we talk about the volatility, as you brought up, I think let's understand why there's volatility, and there should be volatility, and there's a reason for that volatility. And if there wasn't any volatility, then Bitcoin wouldn't be what it claims to be. And what I mean by that is, let's just take the euro dollar. Okay, it's the largest traded currency pair in the world. And if you take the volatility of the euro dollar and you compare it against the volatility to, say, the dollar rand, the dollar rand is much more volatile than the euro dollar. And effectively, the main reason for that is that it's a shallower market.
Mm-hmm.
There are less buyers and sellers in euro dollar rand than there are in euro dollar.
Which allows for more speculation?
No, I suppose it makes it easier to move a market.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you've got a shallow market and you're a very, very big buyer, then you can come into that market and move the price because you've got such a big position. It's very, very difficult to move a market when any particular entity in that market is irrelevant compared to the whole. Right now with Bitcoin, there are many people that hold the bulk of Bitcoins. Let me rephrase that.
Sure.
There are a few people, although there are, let's just say that there are a few people that can move the market in a very, very big way, right? And if you looked at their holdings as a percentage of Bitcoin overall, and then looked at somebody else, like some of the richest people's holdings in the dollar, and looked at their percentage as the dollar market overall, I mean, there's much more concentration of wealth within the Bitcoin system and other cryptocurrencies than there is in fiat currencies. So what that means is that few individuals can move the market if they wanted to. And also what that means is new people coming into the market can move markets very, very much with big positions. So as time goes on and as the market becomes more liquid, as it becomes deeper, you will see volatility starting to decrease. And we've already started to see that. But Duncan, I mean, you'll know from your social circles, there aren't that many people that you know still that own Bitcoin, right? People are catching on a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So once more and more people come into these cryptocurrencies, then we'll start seeing it stabilizing a little bit more. Once things are starting to be priced in Bitcoin or in other things, then we'll start seeing it stabilize a bit more. But volatility is the name of the game, and it's nothing to be worried about. From the perspective of the evolution of this asset class, it's a natural progression of where this asset class is.
Some people are suggesting that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are going through a similar cycle to what we saw in the development of the internet. If you look at the chart of the NASDAQ in the US, there was a huge run-up and bubble in around 2000, 2001, and then there was a massive crash.
Yeah.
And then over a period of 10 to 15 years, it slowly built itself up again. And as these internet companies now are, have the highest valuations of any companies in the world. Back in 2002, I think you would have been hard pressed to find someone who was bullish on internet stocks.
Sure.
Yet they've been hugely successful. Do you think we're in a similar sort of wave with crypto? Are we, is crypto money right now in that 2000 peak phase where there was a lot of volatility? Are we heading for a massive crash followed by a long upswing?
So let's go back to 2013. Because in 2013, as you know, at the end of that year, the price went up to about $1,200. Shortly thereafter, the price crashed 90%. All right. So since then, and 90 is a 90%.
Yes.
And since then, it's been going up and up and up. And remember, we, you know, many people that are coming into this game late are seeing the prices now. There was extreme jubilation when the Bitcoin hit parity with the US dollar, right? Extreme jubilation. And people thought that was a huge bubble. And it crashed down to some cents against against the dollar. And then it went up to $6. And I remember one of the people that I work with, he had some bunch of Bitcoin and he said, oh my goodness, this must be a bubble. I'm selling all my Bitcoin. And he sold his Bitcoin because he thought he caught the top of it, which is at $6, right? Went down to $2 or whatever it was. So the point is it goes up and down, up and down, up and down. And we're seeing that a lot, you know. And so a lot of the press in the last couple of weeks has said, has been showing these, you know, declines of over 30% in cryptocurrencies. That kind of misses the fact that it's grown over 500% since the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
Forget about since what we were talking about when it hit parity in 2011. So my view is that we need to think about what value is. And it's impossible to state the monetary value of anything without referencing something else. So whenever we say Bitcoin, and right now, by the way, it's just, you know, just gone over $4,000, it's $4,000 per Bitcoin, right? So we are measuring the worth of one Bitcoin in terms of US dollars. Now, just for argument's sake, okay, and we see that the dollar has been decoupled from gold since 1971, 46 years. Just for argument's sake, if the dollar crashed for whatever reason, let's say it was inflated out of existence for whatever reason, and we can debate whether that's a realistic scenario or not. But let's say if in the next 50 years the US dollar disappears and Bitcoins are still around and people are still using Bitcoins, then the price of one Bitcoin in terms of US dollars would be infinity, right? Just like today, the price of one Bitcoin in terms of Zimbabwean dollars, which no longer exists, is infinity. I would never give my Bitcoin to anybody unless theoretically they gave me infinity of their Zim dollars. So my point being is that now when you say that, you're like, oh, come on, are you telling me that the price is going to be, you know, infinity? I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is a fact, which is if Bitcoin outlasts the US dollar, the price of Bitcoin in terms of US dollars is infinity. So people are taking a view as well on fiat currencies in this space. Mm-hmm. They're taking a view of cryptocurrencies. But again, the value of anything, you need to look at it in terms of what it's being measured in. So whenever we talk about Bitcoin in terms of dollars, you need to pay attention to whether it's actually dollar going down or if it's Bitcoin going up.
Mm. So are you invested in any of these cryptocurrencies? Do you actively buy in the market?
Let's say I think anybody in this, that's kind of in this space has dabbled.
Yes.
So let's say I've dabbled.
Okay. Okay. And can I ask which cryptocurrencies you've dabbled in?
Several. I think when you look at the different cryptocurrencies there are, as I said, there are over 1,000 of them.
Yeah.
I would be very, very careful to alert your listeners to the fact that there's a difference between cryptocurrencies that are decentralized and distributed, and digital tokens that are not always decentralized and distributed. And we may get a chance to talk about initial coin offerings, ICOs. I do not classify those as cryptocurrencies. Those are issued by a central party. Generally, they're not mined, so there's no kind of participants or network participants that are mining these tokens to create them. They're pre-existent and they're being sold for other cryptocurrencies. And a lot of them are dependent on blockchains like Ethereum, for example.
Yeah.
Some are dependent on other blockchains like BitShares, etc., but a lot of them on Ethereum. So I think it's very important to distinguish the two. But some of the other cryptocurrencies and some of the top ones today are Bitcoin, there's a then Ethereum, Litecoin. There was a fork recently of the Bitcoin protocol, so now there's a fork of Bitcoin just called Bitcoin Cash. Dash, Monero. There are a lot of these that...
In fact, that fork, it feels like so long ago now, but it happened just the other
day.
Yeah,
that's true.
And many people were saying that this is potentially disastrous for Bitcoin. I guess that they've cleared that hurdle, no problem.
Yeah, so it's, you know, and I think we're facing a similar thing right now because there's something called SegWit 2X, where there's meant to be something called segregated witness, which was an update to the current protocol. That's actually been implemented, but that was part of a larger deal within the community to have kind of segregated witness implemented, which is what's called a soft fork. And then, you know, in a couple of months' time to have a hard fork, which is to increase the block size of Bitcoins from 1 megabyte to 2 megabytes. Now, there's a lot of discussion right now whether that's going to actually happen, if people are going to go through with it, if they're not. So there's a potential that there's another hard fork on the horizon in November. And I think that actually dampens the price right now.
Okay.
Whenever there is uncertainty about which way a decentralized community goes in, people express that by kind of exiting for the time being until there's clarity and then re-entering once there's more clarity. So I think if it weren't for that, the price would be much higher. And I think what we will probably find is post-November, you will probably see prices rise further than they are right now, potentially significantly further. But also what that means is between now and then, we may see other big dips in the Bitcoin price. It recently just dipped to, I think, 2,800, 2,900 before it's come back up to 4,000.
And that was from a peak of
$5,000. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
So it lost almost half its value.
I wouldn't be surprised if it went down to 2,500 or somewhere like that. Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Mm-hmm. And one thing you learn quickly in this space when you start understanding the fundamentals is that, as I said earlier, volatility is not a sign of a bad currency. Volatility is a sign of an immature market that is maturing.
Just lastly, on the issue of Bitcoin value, would you advise the man in the street to buy right now? Are they missing out on the investment of a lifetime by sitting it out?
This is a great question. So I think everybody in this space needs to have a little bit of humility. We don't know exactly where things are going. I can tell you what my personal beliefs are. But generally, I think the advice that I give to anybody is this is a really powerful force that's taking place in society. And it's worth taking a little bit of money and entering this space, this cryptocurrency space. But the amount of money that you put in should not be an amount that will drastically hurt you if you lose it all. Mm. So get in, and what that will make you do is pay attention.
Yes.
You know, it can't be so little that it's totally immaterial. It can't be so material that it's going to kill you if the price drops by half, right? But it should be enough that keeps your attention. And once your attention is kept, you'll start asking questions. Why did it just drop? Why has the price just gone up? You'll start reading more about it. You'll start learning more about it. And as you do that, you'll build up your own conviction to determine whether this is real, whether it's fake, whether this is a bubble, whether it's the most undervalued asset class in the world right now, which I do believe it is. So as a cryptocurrency space.
The most undervalued asset class in the world.
I will say that with pride. I think it is the most undervalued asset class in the world right now. It currently stands at about $135 billion. Mm-hmm. That is not even a drop in the ocean of the world's financial system. Not even a drop. Mm. A couple of the world's richest people right now are worth more than the entire market cap of Bitcoin. Okay. Sorry, that's cryptocurrencies.
Sure.
Bitcoin right now is, I think, standing around $70 billion.
It's the biggest of them.
Yeah, it's the biggest one.
Yeah. But is Bitcoin the one that's going to be the dominant cryptocurrency, or are there potential rivals on the horizon? Are there rivals that already exist that actually do stuff better than Bitcoin does?
There are. There are lots of rivals. So it depends on what you want to do with your cryptocurrency. Bitcoin has blocks that get processed about every 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Now, there's also something called the Lightning Network, which will allow more kind of off-chain transactions, which won't be subject to the constraints of on-chain transactions, which is that those on average 10-minute blocks. It's still under development, and actually one of the prerequisites for that was what was called segregated witness. So now that we have that, we'll start seeing a lot of flourishing of kind of off-chain transactions that allows you to kind of circumvent some of the challenges with scalability on-chain. But there are lots of other cryptocurrencies that do amazing things. So Bitcoin is not a very good cryptocurrency for privacy, right? There are others like Monero, Zcash, Dash, etc., that perform much better to preserve the privacy of the participants in that network than Bitcoin. And in fact, a lot of people in the public think Bitcoin is anonymous. Whereas when you talk to the feds in the US, they love Bitcoin because they can piece things together so easily. And they've already put people behind bars because of the very fact that every single Bitcoin transaction in history has been recorded on a public ledger.
Right. So it's not anonymous at all.
It's not. I mean, it's pseudonymous. So you have, you know, a public address that's a string of letters and numbers. A kind of, if you want to think about it, it's like your bank account number. If you gave your bank account number and you put it on a billboard, it doesn't mean anything to anybody. It's just a string of numbers. So to answer your question, whether Bitcoin will be the one that eventually wins out, I don't know. I think it certainly has the largest network right now, and it's acting as kind of the reserve currency in the cryptocurrency world. And so as much as the volatility exists within Bitcoin, within the crypto world, people go into Bitcoin to have reduced volatility and they go out of Bitcoin to kind of, you know, get access to volatility in other currencies, other cryptocurrencies. So, you know, when you think about also social networks, Duncan, it's very easy to create another social network right now from a software perspective. It would be very difficult to take on Facebook, though, because of Facebook's network effect. And the same thing we'll start seeing with money as well, and with cryptocurrencies. So one thing I'd like to add, actually, if I may, is just kind of the difference between fiat currency and then cryptocurrencies, which is the fact that fiat currency right now is limited really by a nation state, right? So you can use rands in South Africa and maybe a little bit beyond, certainly not in New York. You can use dollars in the US, but you can't really use your dollars to pay for your coffee in Europe or your, you know, coffee over here in South Africa. So that idea of the nation state being a limiting factor is completely dispelled by cryptocurrencies. That's one of the most beautiful things.
They're global.
We'll talk a little bit more about this, I think, a little bit
later. Yeah, we will indeed. Yeah. Before we move on, though, you wanted to chat a bit. I know in our initial discussion, you wanted to chat a bit about distributed systems and something called the FAT protocol.
Yeah.
What is that? I know you said that in blockchains, the protocol itself is the token of value, whereas in the internet, the protocol like HTTP is free and the value has been created on top of that at the application.
Sure, it's a wonderful term. That was kind of propagated by some great thinkers within Silicon Valley. And it's a term that's getting more and more traction. When you think about the protocol layer in our internet systems today, you'll be familiar with things like TCP/IP, HTTP, SMTP. These are the protocols, the languages that we use to make sure that our computers can speak to one another and that we can send emails to one another. We can load website pages, you know, that are produced on one side of the world, yet, you know, viewed on another side of the world. Now, there is no charge to using that protocol right now. You know, anybody can use HTTP, TCP/IP. It's a protocol. It's a standard, and it can. It's not really monetized. The only way it's monetized is through the application level on top of these protocols. So, if you think about Google and Facebook, and you know, whoever else, Instagram, etc., guys, and applications that are being built on this worldwide network, they're therefore capturing the value. And so the only really way to capture the value of this is to buy their shares. Okay. Now, in this new paradigm, well, in that old paradigm, again, the reason we say it was a thin protocol is because if you looked at a graph with the value captured on the y-axis, it would, you know, the protocol itself wouldn't go very high at all. There's no monetary value, so to speak. But the FAT protocol is saying, actually now, the protocols have tokens of value associated with them, because one of the most amazing things about this new technology is its ability to create scarce digital assets, right? We've never had that before, right? Anything that was digital could be copy and pasted for basically zero cost, and it could be copy and pasted an infinite number of times. So now that we have a protocol that has a digital value or token associated with it, as that protocol network grows and more people come onto it, then generally they're accessing it by buying the token itself as well. And as more people come into that network, they start buying the token, the price keeps going up. And if you are an early adopter, then financially you can benefit. Think about Facebook. If you're one of the first adopters of Facebook and then you got fed up of it after 10 years or whatever it was, and it was actually depressing you more than making you happy, and you left the Facebook network, you may have got a lot of people onto it, but you left it, and from a financial perspective, you were no better off. So that's an important distinction. And then the application layer in this new world of FAT protocols is we're having these things called distributed and decentralized applications, DApps or DApps. And what these are is saying, well, actually, a lot of the work that's being done in this space is done in the open source field. And so if we can create some code and offer it to the community, then we can actually start creating ecosystems which actually don't cost much to use. You just need to have a token to access them. The token will cost you some money. So we're kind of flipping the entire world on its head, where centralized systems, whereas they were the ones that garnered the most value, in the future, it may not be that at all. The protocol may be where a lot of the value sits.
Okay. Let's talk about banks.
Sure.
You wrote a very good open letter to Jamie Dimon last week, in which you took on the JP Morgan Chase CEO for his remarks about Bitcoin being a fraud. I recommend anyone who hasn't read it to go and do so. Do you think that Dimon made those? Why do you think he made those remarks? Do you think he feels threatened by crypto?
So let's see what to say here. There's lots to say. Thank you. I think Jamie Dimon has done very well for himself. And I don't know exactly how old he is. I think he's maybe 61 or 62 years old. He's got an illustrious career behind him. Has done very well, as I mentioned. And really, he's done very well in a paradigm that is changing now. So I actually don't think that he made those. I think he sincerely meant those comments.
Okay.
I don't think he was. And you know, a lot of people in the social media space were saying that he's made those comments to maybe crash the price, and then JP Morgan is buying it as the price is going. I don't think that's the actual case. I actually think those comments are genuine, mm-hmm. And I just think it's based on the fact that he's lived in a world and is so entrenched in a world that he knows well, that has been his reality for so long, that now that it's changing. Mm. He doesn't necessarily have the time, you know, nor the tools to actually understand it, because it's such a different paradigm. So I remember when I was learning about this stuff, it questions everything you thought you knew about money and our financial system. And it is such a powerful concept, and it can be dismissed so easily. And I personally dismissed it when I first heard about Bitcoin. And I remember that bubble, so to speak, in 2013 when it went up to over $1,000 and crashed again. The thought that went through my mind is, of course, it's just a bubble. Of course it was going to crash. I mean, what were these guys thinking? So with Jamie Dimon, I think over time he'll understand more and more. But as I said, I think it probably comes from the fact that he's so busy. Mm-hmm. He probably doesn't have the time to look into this stuff. He's very quick to dispel it. But I think over time, we'll see actually what happens with this asset class.
Maybe it'll be a bit like Bill Gates, who said in the 1980s, 640K is enough for anyone.
What was that?
Bill Gates, Microsoft CEO, said in the 1980s that 640K ought to be enough for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
So banks, are they threatened by crypto? Isn't one of the main functions of a bank to act as a trusted intermediary, and doesn't blockchain do away with the need for that?
Sure. So let's talk about what banks do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that banks deal with money, which is true. And they deal with their local currency, which is also true, but they also deal with other currencies and foreign exchange, FX. But if you actually look at what banks do, it's very simple. Banks are in the value business. They do four things with value. The first thing is that they store value, call it a deposit. The second thing is that they transfer value, call it payments if you want. The third thing is that they provide value, whether it's debt or equity. And then the fourth thing is that they protect value, whether that's through insurance or derivatives. So whatever that value is shouldn't actually make a difference to banks. And I think the forward-looking institutions will say, we're in the value business. Wherever there is value, we'll play in that space. So if you look at the top banks in the world right now, yes, they deal in rands, in dollars, in pounds, etc. But they also deal in gold, in oil, in pork bellies, in wheat, in corn. And that's because all of these things have value, and these banks buy and sell them, and they provide markets for them, futures markets, forwards, etc. So my view is that in the future, I think people will start seeing this new asset class becoming much more prevalent in society. We like to kind of victimize banks. I think it's a kind of common trend out there, and sometimes for good reason, because banks have done things that are not so ethical in the past. It doesn't mean that all banks are like that. It doesn't mean that all people in banks are like that. But if you look at some of the top providers right now in the crypto space, if you look at Coinbase, for example, they're a great company and they've done great things. But what are they doing right now? They are storing your cryptocurrency for you. You must trust Coinbase. Mm-hmm. Coinbase holds the private keys of its customers. And if something happened with Coinbase, well, then there'll be a lot of complaints. So we don't look at Coinbase as a bank. It doesn't have a banking license, etc. But it performs one of the functions of banks, which is storing of value. So I think those banks that view cryptocurrencies as a threat, I think haven't really understood what their business is. And as banks realize that they're in the value business, cryptocurrency, far from being a threat, is an absolutely great opportunity.
And one thing banks are good at is security, and security is so crucial in this new area. I mean, we've seen so many reports about exchanges getting hacked and
right.
people losing a lot of money to criminals.
Correct.
And I suppose banks, one thing banks are very good at is keeping people's money safe.
So yeah, banks are good at that for the most part. I mean, not always.
Sure, not always.
we've seen some of those examples. And actually, the security that's required in this space is a little bit different to the type of security that banks have traditionally been used to. Mm. They certainly have some of the skills, but not all the skills. So I think we'll start seeing like a lot of changes in the financial system over the next couple of decades. From a regulatory perspective, to who the players are, to how the services are provisioned and how customers interact with these providers. It's a very exciting space to be in at the moment.
So one of the big criticisms of Bitcoin is that it's difficult to use as a day-to-day spending currency, which probably made the announcement by Pick and Pay at the weekend that it is testing Bitcoin wallet payments at the point of sale so interesting. Mm-hmm. Does it become a day-to-day payment mechanism down the line, or is that not really Bitcoin's function?
I think there's a lot of debate about that. I think it can certainly be that, especially with new kind of advances with things like the Lightning Network that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. I think it's a super exciting advance, and I think it's a super exciting piece of news that Pick and Pay is doing this. It's not a new thing. There are many, you know, retailers around the world, Expedia, Dell, Microsoft, etc., that have previously kind of made mention of their accepting of Bitcoin. And what I think it does is that it just kind of focuses the attention on this space from several different participants. So other retailers now are going to start looking at this. Banks are going to start looking at this more closely. Regulators are going to start trying to understand what does this actually even mean. Mm-hmm. And so there's still a great need for regulatory clarity. In this country, in South Africa, we've had two papers, one from the South African Reserve Bank and one from National Treasury at the end of 2014. Effectively saying that virtual currencies, as they call them, are risky. They are not legal tender. Legal tender just means that it needs to be accepted by a merchant, but they're not illegal to hold. And that if you do hold them, please note that they're risky, and that there's no recourse to the central bank if you incur any losses. That's effectively what. And also the other things like exchange control. That's another law here. Are still applicable. So I think it's very exciting because the world right now hasn't taken this asset class so seriously up until relatively recently. Mm. And I think it is an incredible force that needs to be taken very seriously, to be understood, to understand its impact on our current financial systems, understand its impact on monetary policies, understand its impact on our economies. I think a lot of research still needs to be done. We still need to understand a lot, you know. And so the thing is, like, we live in a very complex world. And so there are people, let's say, that have done a lot of research on, you know, the impacts of a gold standard when, you know, our money supply was restricted by gold. And a lot of them have said, well, that's one of the things that led to the depression in the 1920s. And so one of the ideas of going off gold is that you can expand your money supply as your economy grows without being constrained by a limited supply. So on the one side, that may say, okay, that's good that you have some constraint. On the other side, as we said, maybe it's not such a good thing. We have gone off the gold standard. The fact of the matter is Bitcoin is a finite currency. There's only 21 million. There will be 21 million. Currently, just over 16.5 million that exist. So Bitcoin is what we call a deflationary currency. That over time, it is expected that other goods and services, their prices will go down in terms of Bitcoin. And another way of saying that is that Bitcoin's price will continue to rise. And it's the same thing with gold. You know, a stat that I want to share is that we seldom think about how well or badly gold has done against the US dollar. The fact of the matter is that the dollar has lost 97% of its value against gold since 1971. That's 46 years. I can't remember exactly what the CAGR is right now, the compounded annual growth rate. Last time I calculated it, it was about 8% per annum that gold was outstripping the value of the dollar. So I think the benefit of this announcement is that there will be much more attention paid, and people will realize very quickly that we need to start understanding what this is and understanding how it interacts with our current financial system.
I'm interested in just picking up one point you made there about the devaluation and the value of the dollar. We see it across all currencies, of course. Yeah. The rand as well has devalued by more than the dollar, I believe, over the decades.
Absolutely.
In a way, the central bank almost kind of manages this devaluation in that they target inflation and there's an expectation that there's this devaluation going on. Is that the wrong expectation? Are the central banks mismanaging fiat currencies?
So, you know, I think we've come a long way in our learning, and I think we will continue to learn. And I think, you know, a lot of people demonize central banks, and I think that's not the right thing to do. I think central bankers are trying to do their best in the system that we currently have. Their tools are limited. I think some of the results they're producing are limited, and we'll continue to learn more about that. But we must understand that right now, and we don't think about it like this, but central banks intend to devalue their currency every year. They don't say that, but what they do say is that they have an inflation target. Mm-hmm. And an inflation target in this country is 3 to 6%. In the US and in Europe, it's 2%. But all that means is that other prices are rising relative to the US dollar. And remember what I said a little bit earlier is that anything has value that has value needs to be measured in something else. So effectively, by having an inflation target, all that means is that you're trying to devalue your currency against other goods and services, a basket of other goods and services. You measure that through something called CPI, the Consumer Price Index, and you're trying to achieve a particular devaluation of your currency. Some of the thinking there is that as you devalue your currency, because it's not something you want to hold on to, you spend it and it's good for the economy.
Right.
Because then, you know, there's a velocity of money, which means that your money is just going to be circulating in the economy. The more your money gets spent, the more the other people have received that money and then they can spend it. And the more kind of circulation of that money, the more richer and more vibrant your economy is. So that's some of the thinking behind that. But as you know, that's a very, very fine line between devaluing your currency, you know, at 3 to 6% or 2%, and making sure that you don't lose the faith and confidence of the economy that's using your currency. And when that happens, it's pretty much impossible to go back. We've seen that in Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. You see what's happening in Venezuela today with incredible amounts of inflation there. This happened in the 1920s in Germany. So It's the central banks, I think, are doing their best with the tools that they have. They have very limited tools, in my opinion. And the fact that many global central banks, or the largest central banks, have started talking about moving into unconventional monetary policy space, I think is implicitly stating that conventional monetary policy has been reaching its limits. And if we look at interest rates by some accounts are the lowest that they've been in about 5,000 years. If you look at our growth rates, you know, we're hitting low growth rates compared to where we've been in the past several decades, right? So we're hitting this new kind of funky economic and monetary paradigm that I think anybody that claims to fully understand is fooling themselves. So we will continue to learn and make adjustments to our monetary system, but there's a lot of learning for us to do.
Let's get back to Bitcoin and crypto.
Sure.
There's a lot of talk now about regulating it. Central banks are talking about it, governments are talking about it.
Yeah.
But isn't the primary attraction, or at least one of the main attractions of cryptocurrencies, that they are anonymous? Now, I know we spoke about Bitcoin being pseudonymous, but there are many cryptocurrencies that do promise you full anonymity. Isn't that one of their primary isn't that one of the main reasons people are attracted to them? If you have to apply FICA-type legislation to Bitcoin, for example, are there still inherent advantages to holding it over fiat currencies?
Sure, sure. So let's talk a little bit about, again, in this, in the context of history.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a relatively new thing that money is regulated. Right? Before, if money was gold, well, if you find a piece of gold and you've got gold, well, nobody regulates that. You can use it, right? A cow in the past, as we said, a shell. You don't, you know, regulate how many shells you're allowed to pick from the beach, for example, right? Or salt, whatever it may be. So it's a relatively new thing that money is a centralized system, if you want to think about that. That's kind of issued by a central authority. It's very, very new. And I think people in the past and people in the future maybe may look and say, this is quite a big anomaly. So now when it comes to regulating these things, my opinion is that you can't actually regulate them in and of themselves, right? You know, it's like, what harm is there to another human being if I have some Bitcoin right now? I can't see any harm that I've done to anybody or anything like that. But some of the challenges come when people are using other monetary systems to get into this system. So I believe that the future regulation of this won't be the regulation of Bitcoin in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't tell people you cannot have Bitcoin. That's my view.
Mm-hmm.
You can't tell them you cannot
have Bitcoin. Like the Chinese are trying to do now.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell them, but to enforce that is pretty much impossible.
Mm.
Okay. So what I believe is that we'll have the interfaces and the gateways between cryptocurrencies and national currencies that become regulated. Like right now, when you think about the South African rand and people that live here, when they want to buy US dollars or other assets abroad, you have an allowance, exchange control allowance, that you can take off X amount of rands every year. I think probably cryptocurrencies will start falling into such type of regulations. Because what they're actually trying to do there is preserve their own currency. But they're not saying that you can't buy a US dollar. They're just saying the amount that you can buy legally is X, right? Even that may have its challenges. But the point is that if you regulate exchanges that go between fiat currency and cryptocurrencies, then conceivably the regulators can ask those exchanges to provide them with information on who's doing that, who's going in and out of their own currency. And how much they're doing that with. But once you're in the other currency, once you have a Bitcoin, very, very difficult to regulate. Very, very difficult to regulate.
And if you're using another cryptocurrency that does guarantee or provide absolute anonymity, then the authorities have no view into what you're doing or the transactions you're doing with someone else.
Correct, correct. So I think, again, it's the gateways that regulators, if they really wanted to, regulate this, and as I said, we can have the conversation about whether it's a good or a bad thing, is they could say, okay, well, take a Pick and Pay, you know exactly where they are, you know who the CEO is, it's a publicly traded company, etc. Now you can stipulate it's against the law to accept cryptocurrency, so, and that will certainly stop people buying with cryptocurrency at particular outlets. But it doesn't mean that people will stop using cryptocurrency, because people can still use cryptocurrency in their own capacity. There might be some people that do accept it. The world is becoming more of a decentralized place without bricks and mortar stores and things like that. So again, to recap, regulating a cryptocurrency in and of itself, I think, is a horrible idea. To ban a cryptocurrency in and of itself is a horrible idea. But if regulators really wanted to regulate it, and the biggest reason to do that is to understand the interaction with its own monetary system, is to actually understand what's happening at the gateway.
Yeah. I'm hoping to have a follow-up conversation at some point in the coming months with the South African Reserve Bank on all of these issues.
But
I know you do a lot of work with the Reserve Bank. You're head of the South African Financial Blockchain Consortium. What at a high level, I don't want you to speak on behalf of the South African Reserve Bank, but what at a high level is happening from a regulatory perspective and sort of the central bank's thinking about how to deal with crypto money?
So I think there's a lot that's happening at the South African Reserve Bank right now. They've just established a fintech unit that's public knowledge. They have 3 full-time employees there. It's probably going to be growing from there, I would imagine. And they've kind of been mandated to try to understand what's going on and to help the Reserve Bank understand what's required for a central bank to do in this space. So as I said, their official position has been out from a couple of years ago. They're certainly looking into it. I think they have some great people working there that are trying to understand this. And at the end of the day, a regulator's role should really be to serve the interests of the people it serves. And so any regulator, any central bank will need to start thinking very carefully about how they do that as it relates to cryptocurrencies.
Okay. Let's get on to the juicy stuff.
Sure.
The big picture stuff. Let's talk about how cryptocurrencies have the potential to change the social structures of humanity. Money up till now has been a national phenomenon. Certainly currencies have. In many respects, a fiat currency like the rand almost defines the nation state.
Correct.
What is a country without a national currency? Yet national currencies, you think, may actually go away at some point in the not too distant future. Talk us through this stuff.
All right, sure.
I mean, this is world changing potentially.
I think it really is. I'd like to give you a little example, Duncan. Let's take Johannesburg. Okay, Johannesburg has lots of different suburbs. Bryanston, Sandton, say, or let's call it Bryanston, Sandton, and let's say Soweto, for example. Now, just imagine each of those suburbs had its own coin, its own currency, that was only accepted in the shops within that suburb. And that whenever you wanted to travel between the different suburbs, you needed to go to a provider that would exchange the coin from the suburb you're just coming from to the coin that, of the suburb you're going to. And they will charge you a little fee for that privilege. Now, I think nobody would want such a system where I need to now go and take my Bryanston coin, exchange it in Soweto so that I can spend my Soweto coin in a shop or at a restaurant in Soweto. And we're thankful that in Johannesburg we have the rand that can be used anywhere within Johannesburg. And if you take it a step higher, it can be used anywhere in South Africa. But if you take it a step higher, we're back into the same scenario that we just had. The world is becoming smaller. You can have, lunch or breakfast in Paris and lunch in London and dinner in New York. Mm-hmm. But if you did that, you would need to pay in different currencies. Now, of course, we have mechanisms to facilitate that. We have credit cards that make it easy to do that, but you're still paying fees because you're doing that. So when you think of it from that perspective, and the fact that we still have a South African coin and a China coin and a Euro coin and a US coin, you think, well, if the world is becoming a smaller and smaller place, and that actually the interchange of these currencies is causing friction, economic friction, and trade friction, then surely it would be better to have some type of a universal system of currencies, whether it's one currency or several, we will have to find out. But that brings a lot of other questions onto the table, which is we look at the euro. And the euro is an experiment that I think many people would say the verdict is still not out. One of the main reasons for that is that when you have monetary union, to have fiscal union, meaning your tax base, is one, and political union is extremely important. So in Europe, you don't have fiscal union, and you don't have political union, yet you have monetary union. So that's why you have a lot of people saying, no, we shouldn't have had the euro. The Greeks should have had the drachma so that now they could devalue their currency and then they can compete with their exports, etc. But we don't have those type of conversations about, let's say, KZN in South Africa saying, if only KZN had its own currency, it could devalue it so it could compete against Gauteng. Or we don't say that about California and if it had its own currency. And the reason is because an American is an American, a South African is a South African. A European still is not a European, if that makes sense. Like the value and the life of a Greek is not seen necessarily the same as that of a German. So, and this is kind of where my spiritual kind of inspirations and learnings have been very instrumental to my forming my thinking, which is the first thing we need to do is recognize our unity. If we continue at the nation state and we start having, you know, fights about nation states and, you know, because of borders which are man-made, then having one single currency of the whole world makes absolutely no sense. Mm. But I think what we will see is just how man-made borders have changed over time and encompassed larger and larger populations. We'll start to see that actually the human race will start becoming one. I know that's not necessarily what you're hearing in the news with things between North Korea and the US and Brexit, etc. But I think these are natural road bumps in our progression towards world unity. And the beautiful thing is, if you look at this from a spiritual perspective, from the Baha'i Faith says that world peace is not only possible, but it's inevitable. We'll get there. There might be a lot of suffering before we get there. And then you look at like some very, very secular pieces of writing, like Yuval Harari's Sapiens, which is a great read if you haven't read it.
I've actually downloaded an Audible. Okay, I haven't had a chance to listen to it.
It's a great book, but he's coming from a purely scientific perspective, saying the world is also moving towards unity. So both of these things were moving. The world is moving towards unity.
But this has bigger potential implications for nation states and the way humans have ordered their existence for quite a long time.
Correct.
Now, the nation state itself, of course, is not that old.
It's only about 400 years old.
Only 400 years old. So what happens when there is no more government-backed fiat money? You believe that the US dollar eventually is going away, the rand is going away. What happens in that world? Do we end up, I mean, you spoke about network effects. We've certainly seen network effects on the internet where one company tends to dominate something. So Google dominates search, Facebook dominates social.
Right.
Those same network effects, do they suggest that at some point we're going to have one global dominant cryptocurrency? And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Sure. So first of all, when I look at any monetary system, it changes, right? So when I talk about the rand or the dollar, I think it's reasonable to suggest that in 1 or 2,000 years, humanity won't be using the rand or the dollar. I think that's a pretty uncontroversial statement to make. So the question is, well, does that change in 1,000 years? Does it change in 500 years? Does it change in 50 years? Does it change in 5 years? And I don't think anybody has the answer to that question. So I'm making more of a macro kind of statement about kind of the evolution of the human race over longer periods of time. But really calling into question are kind of strongly held assumptions that the world will continue as it is. You know, we've been born in this world. It's kind of using the rand in South Africa. And it's kind of natural to think that the rand is always going to exist.
It's how we've always understood
it. Absolutely. But the rand actually only came into existence in 1961, Valentine's Day 1961. So many people that are already alive right now lived at a time that the rand didn't exist. Okay? So that's, I think, one just general statement to say that things change. Now, when we talk about a world currency, as I said, the vision that I kind of shared with you about the world becoming a unified place, there are two processes in which that could happen. The first is an orderly one, and the second is a disorderly one. And the orderly one is to say, well, the countries of the world and the governments of the world will come together to say, actually, you know, this idea of nation states, while it's great and it served its purpose in the history of human evolution, maybe its time is coming to an end. And really, does it really make sense to have this border? Like, what is the purpose of it? And actually, it serves to divide us more than it serves to unify us oftentimes. Now, I don't know about you, but looking kind of the governments and the leaders of our world, I find it very difficult to imagine that kind of transition where people say, okay, let's actually come together and recognize the rights of a human being as a human being, not a human being as an American or a human being as a Mexican or a German or a South African. So that's going to be difficult. The other way, as I said, is a disorderly one. And we see that the world progresses with crisis and victory, crisis and victory. And so some of the things that I see on the news today worry me. And I think we like to believe that nothing drastic is going to happen in our world. That's simply not the reality of how things work. So I think there are many elements in our society where there could be some drastic changes. With those drastic changes, it could come with drastic consequences to the way we organize ourselves, the money that we have, etc.
I was just going to ask, doesn't the sort of change that we're talking about here inevitably lead to conflict? Are we not at risk, as nation-state governments lose some of the power that they have enjoyed, that we have a world war?
So, I often wonder what it felt like to be alive in 1913 or in 1938. 1913, the World War didn't exist. Yet the following year it erupted. 1938, same thing with World War II. So it worries me when I actually see some of the rhetoric that's happening between some of our leaders. And sometimes we just see a news headline and we think, okay, it will subside. I fear that maybe one of these times we will see that it may not subside. And if that happens, then we've got a lot of problems ahead of us as a society. Now, logically, we've amassed great weapons of mass destruction as a human race. Oh yeah, we had the atomic bomb, Hiroshima, etc. But we've assumed that people won't use that because logically, there are better ways to solving things than nuking a place. Unfortunately, I think some of our leaders around the world are not the most rational sometimes, and some of our leaders, many of our leaders around the world, are not the most humble.
I wonder who you might be referring to.
So a lot of, I think, there may be some consequences that come out of some unintended actions that lead to some unintended consequences.
Yeah, I mean, it could be argued that in many respects, nation states have thrived because they have a monopoly over violence. They can violently take your money through tax.
Correct.
Like it or not, they'll claim their pound of flesh.
Yeah.
You don't have a choice. You have to pay tax. But what if people can hide their earnings from the government?
Sure.
What if they're using a cryptocurrency to buy goods and services to earn money, and the government and the tax authorities have no sight of that?
Sure. So I'm going to paint a picture for you that's a little bit longer term.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just a vision. It goes against what many people within the crypto community actually believe. A lot of them are libertarians, as you know, and they don't want government, and they don't like any centralized rule, etc. I think that's misled, personally. I think the reason that humanity has been able to have so much prosperity in the last few decades and century, and even century and a half compared to its previous history, is because we've had governance structures that have allowed a rule of law, etc. Now, it's not perfect. We've got a lot of corruption. We've got a lot of issues with our current system. But having a rule of law is extremely important. And if you have a rule of law, that means that rule of law must be applicable to everybody, whether you like it or not, right? So if we think about the scenario that you've just painted, where people say, listen, we don't want governments, forget tax, I hate paying my tax, etc. Well, then what happens to public goods, like roads, like bridges, right? Like education systems, right?
Well, libertarian would argue that those things can simply be provided by the market.
You know, I think if you look at economics, there are certain things like public goods that are not very well provisioned by markets. And actually, the market forces don't provide them well. There's something called the tragedy of the commons.
Mm-hmm.
right? So when you have the tragedy of the commons, when everybody uses something that's free, like a park, well, then if they're not taking responsibility for it, then it can be degraded. So I really believe that anything in excess is actually not a good thing. And I'm going to say something controversial here. Mm-hmm. I think liberty in excess is not a good thing. And let me explain that. We complain so much in the mornings when we come to work and the traffic light is not working. Mm. Right? And we can see that it causes traffic and congestion, etc. What is a traffic light? A traffic light is a law. It's a regulation. And we all know that if everybody abides by that regulation, because we all have different intentions and different kind of ways we're going, those laws and those traffic lights facilitate the movement of humans to get to where they want to quicker. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we said, no rules, everybody do whatever you want, be free to do whatever you want, I can guarantee you we would not be getting to our intended destinations quicker than now where we have traffic lights. Mm-hmm. So my point being is that I think rules of law are good things. I think what humanity rebels against is that when there's injustice in the system, where people say there's meant to be a rule of law, but it doesn't apply to everybody, or there's a lot of corruption, or those that are in a position of power and authority don't actually enact that power or demonstrate that power with responsibility. So my view is that actually in the future, we will have a global governance structure. We will have a global legislature. We'll have a global executive force. We'll have a global judiciary. And again, this is also a lot of my thinking coming from the Baha'i writings. And it makes sense to me. That's the way the world has kind of migrated, the way it's evolved. It doesn't make sense to me for us to kind of degrade into barbaric times when we were cavemen. Mm-hmm. And when we didn't like someone, the concept of justice was to bash them over the head with a club and to kill someone to get your own way. That doesn't make any sense. We're mature. We're maturing. So the rule of law needs to mature. We need to make sure that justice prevails. Until justice prevails, we will not have world peace. But I do believe that over time, not in my lifetime, we will get closer and closer to justice. And we're seeing that even in my own life, right? Where, even think about the Arab Spring. You're having huge revolutions that are taking place where people are fed up with the injustice of their governments. In the cryptocurrency space, people are fed up with some of their financial systems. And they're rebelling against it with new technologies, etc. So I think over time, we will see a different race, when I say race, a different human race, a different kind of culture is required to get to a more prosperous society.
Okay. You believe in the innate goodness of mankind, whereas I think maybe Ayn Rand influenced libertarians to take the opposite view in that they believe the individual is the one that...
I encourage you to actually look into some of the Baha'i writings because... Yeah. Actually, there's so many beautiful checks and balances. Within the Baha'i faith, there is no single individual that has any power whatsoever. There's actually elected institutions that get elected. But the election process itself is very different to the way we think about it. Mm. Campaigning is not allowed. Talking about who you're voting for is not allowed. It's a secret ballot vote. So even the way our systems work right now, I think, are very primitive. So just a side note. When we talk about elections and we look at our leaders, many people complain about their leaders. We very, very seldom question our system that generates those leaders as much as we do the candidates themselves. And I always say, in today's society, with most of our electoral systems, generally the very process to get your name onto a public ballot disqualifies you in many cases from the qualities required to lead. So there's a big changes that are required within our system.
Before we move on, I just want to end off that topic by asking about encryption. Encryption has become a divisive concept, particularly amongst politicians. I know the British government has made some, the former Prime Minister David Cameron made some remarks about this some time ago that earned him some severe criticism. He said that... I think I might be misquoting him slightly, but he said that technology companies need to build back doors into their products to allow law enforcement to get access so that they can help fight terrorism. the Silicon Valley hit back hard and said this is not possible and you don't understand how encryption works, et cetera, et cetera. And encryption's at the heart of what's happening in money now.
Correct.
Is there any argument to be made that governments should have a back door, or that encryption shouldn't be unbreakable, or that law enforcement should have some access to these transactions that are going on? Is there an argument there, or is putting a back door into anything, or doing away with encryption, mm-hmm. or banning encryption, just a silly idea?
Yeah. You see, going back to what I said earlier, I think we are suffering from a crisis of trust in a society.
Mm.
So many of those people don't trust those authorities who say that they're using it for illicit purposes when they may actually be using it to see what people are doing or to get access to data that they shouldn't have access to.
And of course,
we
saw the Edward Snowden revelations, which give people real reason to worry what's happening with their data.
So my view is, if we had institutions, trusted institutions that we actually trusted, our view towards them would be very different. But I think what we rebel against is that we don't trust our institutions for the most part. You know, and this is something that's becoming more and more prevalent in society, whether it's political institutions, religious institutions, lots of different types of institutions. Mm. Political parties, governments. So I think it's an ongoing debate, this one, between kind of privacy and then having your kind of authorities that are meant to take care of you have the right information at their disposal to be able to take care of you. And so long as the people don't trust in the intention of those institutions, we're going to continue having this. And I think we'll continue having this for many generations to come.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, I think, you know, we complain about, for instance, like South American dictators taking money to bank accounts elsewhere or offshore. And then we say, no, we should get that money back. But then, wait a minute, if there's privacy and we said, no, nobody should ever know where they've taken it, how do you ever get that money back? So there's an inherent kind of conflict between the two. And I think ultimately in the future, we need to find some happy medium that we're happy with, where privacy will be important to people, but there will be truly trusted institutions, mm-hmm. in the future. I don't think it's going to happen in my time, where potentially they would have access to some information that would assist them. But I think with technology, the checks and balances are becoming much more clear to enable such things without compromising privacy completely.
Mm. So we've spoken about nation states and the implications of this for governments. What about central banks? They control fiat currencies. Do they have a bleak future? I know you mentioned that the U.S. had two central banks before the Federal Reserve.
Right.
And you said the status quo never stays the same. So
correct.
What's going to happen to central banks in this new world of crypto money?
Sure. So let's think about central banks. Central banks are not that old, right? One of our banks over here, FNB, is older than the Federal Reserve. Okay, and we think about the Federal Reserve, the U.S. central bank, as an institution that has been around for centuries. It was established in 1913. The Central Bank of South Africa established in 1920. Now, there are a few older ones, like the Bank of England, etc. But even those ones, it's not more than a few hundred years old. That's it. We're not talking about millennia here. We're talking about a few hundred years. Now, again, if you think about the evolution of the human race, and if you think about the fact that really, it has only been 20 years that we've had the internet, plus minus, right? Not plus, not minus, the plus, I should say. In kind of a form that more and more people have started getting access to, 20 years is just a blip on the humanity's timescale. Yet what that 20 years has given us is the ability to know what's happening on the other side of the world in an instant,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, that is fundamentally changing the way we organize ourselves, right? And at the end of the day, I look across the table at you, Duncan. You've got a different skin color to me. You've got a different upbringing. You were brought up in a different country. I don't care. I love you as much as I love anybody else, right? and our kind of divisions that have been created on things like race and national borders and religion, etc., I think more and more are going to start to dissipate, not without difficulty, and we will see a lot of difficulties, but a lot of our prejudices from the past are also starting to disappear in society. You know, witches, we used to have witches in our societies, and then we realized, no, that's not really happening. And we had the inequality between men and women, which we still do. We haven't got anywhere near where we need to get to as the equality, but at least women can vote now. They couldn't vote 100 years ago. You know, black people can vote now.
They can become presidents.
They can become presidents, right? The world is changing fundamentally. So given that backdrop, given the fact that money is becoming much more global, I think maybe the answer to your question is to say, do institutions in the long run that cater to a monetary system of a world of this, of one of the suburbs of the world, have much of a role in a world that's becoming much more global? My view is that things are changing, and they're changing drastically.
There's no doubt that we're in for a very interesting time over the next few decades, because the internet changed things, but this sounds to me like it could have even more impact on the way humans structure their societies and the way we order ourselves, really.
Absolutely. So Saturday night, I mentioned this to you, a drunk driver crashed into the back of my car.
Oh, no.
It was a horrible experience on a number of fronts. Number one, that the guy was completely drunk. I was like toppling over into the flower beds, etc. Second is the police came, very, very corrupt. I think he must have paid them off. Oh. They had a breathalyzer. They said, listen, if this breathalyzer shows that there's no alcohol in his breath, we can't do anything about it. So he blew, and then they showed it to me. They said, see, it says 0.00. And then off he went, and off they went. And I couldn't believe it. So when we see things like that, and we see some of the technologies that are coming out, like self-driving cars, right? And then we see technologies, which I would have loved for him to be in a self-driving car on Saturday night, right?
Or in an Uber.
Or in an Uber, yeah. Exactly.
Where he should have been.
Exactly. Mm. And then we start seeing these advances with data science and AI and then monetary advances as well, and that, you know, the Internet of Things, and where you just have these neural networks and these networks around the whole world that now you can bring value onto it, which, coming back to our very, very early one of the first topics we talked about here, is the allocation of our scarce resources on this planet. You start entering new worlds of how to allocate resources. Right, you start thinking about machines that are wanting to get things done, that maybe have some resources allocated to them that they can then use to expedite certain processes, or self-driving cars that need to get somewhere quicker that pay cars along the way to get out of their way, or all the usual stuff that kind of we've been hearing recently. And when you start having these big changes, I think the human mind actually just cannot comprehend it. And if you think about 1,000 years ago, just what we're doing right now, having a podcast, to think that we're capturing sound and we're able to replay it, and we can capture imagery and be able to replay it.
All over the world.
All
instantly.
Over the world, instantly. We take this as granted. A few hundred years ago, like 100 years ago, this was like revolutionary stuff. So we get so kind of complacent about our advances, and then so haughty and arrogant about where we've come. But I think we're not even at the beginning of where humanity can go in its advances of technology. I personally think that teleportation is probably going to be figured out at some point, where I can actually be somewhere else. Like, to think about it, I know you laugh at me now, but if you tell someone else before that your voice could be on the other side of the world, right now, people would laugh at you. So, it's all a matter of perspective.
Yeah. And I think we tend to get stuck in the moment. We think, well, this is how things are right now, and this is therefore how they always will be.
Absolutely.
But they're not always this. They always change. It's the only constant.
Yeah,
and absolutely. There's this assumption that the monetary system that we live with every day is going to stay with us, but that's not necessarily true.
I think it's absolutely true that it's not going to be staying with us forever.
Yes.
The question is, when is it going to change?
Yes. And how is it going to impact you? And I think many people, they hear the term Bitcoin, and they think really interesting, and I think geeks playing around with money and that sort of thing. But it's probably a good idea if you, as an ordinary consumer, familiarize yourself with what's going on here, because it could have a financial impact on you down the line, right?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, so I have a few older friends who have been very successful in their lives, but I'm not very proficient with using computers or anything that requires some technological savviness.
Right.
These are not stupid people. These are very, very intelligent people. But they've just lived at a time where the technology has kind of gone ahead, and they haven't really kept up. And so, you know, my recommendation to all your listeners right now is that cryptocurrencies are not a fad. They're not something that is, you know, is just a bubble that's going to crash anytime soon. This is a phenomenal advancement in human technology. And to not understand it is to do a disservice to yourself. So I would really, really urge everybody just to try to understand a little bit more. It will open some beautiful vistas for you.
Mm. Fazam Ehsani, this has been a fascinating and wide-ranging discussion. I thank you for taking the time out to talk to Tech Central today. If anyone wants to get hold of you, you're quite active on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah.
What's your handle there?
Farzam Ehsani. That's at FarzamEhsani.
And you're quite a regular speaker at conferences and stuff. So if you get a chance to listen to Fazam, you've obviously heard quite a bit of him today, but he gives great presentations. So look out for him on the
speaker circuit. That's very kind. Thank you, Duncan. Thanks for having me.